Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 66. My name's Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, podcasting. Helen Zaltzman is a podcasting ninja. She's been in the industry of creating DIY radio shows for the internet since 2007. She's seen the landscape of podcasts evolve, and now it's her full-time job. I got her on to talk about the history of podcasting and the future of the platform and online content in general. I really loved hearing her opinions about how she thinks it's going to develop and her comparisons with things like YouTube, which I massively agree with. And she's just so learned and knowledgeable. I really found her fascinating, and it was great to hear her talk about stuff in a context that you don't always, because obviously on her podcast she doesn't talk about the business side of the podcast, or she doesn't go into detail about how they evolved and how they became the shows that they are today. If you want to hear any of her podcasts, you can find them all linked in the show notes, along with all of her social media channels and also her amazing podcast support group on Facebook. It is a constant source of help for me, and it really helps me get going at the start. So if you're looking at starting a podcast and you don't really know where to start, first of all, on my website there's a how to get started in podcasting tutorial. You can also tweet me, email me, message me. I'm more than happy to answer any questions, or you can ask in the group, where there is a lovely supportive network of people who want to help each other get started in this journey of creating their own shows. So feel free to check that out. Without any more delays, this is Helen Zaltzman.
I started podcasting because I did not have any good reasons to say no when my friend Ollie asked me if I wanted to start a podcast, and I didn't know what they were and I hadn't listened to one. So I had no idea what I was getting into. And to be honest, I think that's the best situation, because otherwise I think you can get really freaked out thinking about the technology and the amount of work it is and having to get the internet to care. And all of these are okay. It's just they can look very insurmountable if you think you have to be ready for them before starting. So ignorance was really key to me starting and then carrying on.
Okay. And what was the pitch? So Ollie came to you with an idea, not the other way around.
Ollie approached me at the housewarming party for the flat we're sitting in now. And this is nearly 10 years ago. And he said, I want to talk to you alone. And I thought, God, is he dying? And he said, do you want to start a podcast? Because he thought those were going to be the next thing. And he'd been kind of ahead of the curve on blogs. So we didn't know what it would be yet. And there weren't that many around. Ricky Gervais was the prevalent British podcast. I hadn't really listened to that. I'd listened to the podcasted version of Adam and Joe's XFM radio show, which you can probably still get. And then a friend gave Ollie the advice, make sure it's not just two people talking shit, which is why we thought better put in a format. And the format came quite quickly, because Ollie said, oh, you did the student radio show, which is like these little plays about fundamental questions. And I was like, well, fundamental questions, that's a bit dry. So put in agony aunt type questions as well. And so it was fairly quick to think it up. But I think if you were starting now, this was like 2006, we thought that up. Now, there are so many more podcasts, and there's a lot more choice of entertainment on demand online as well, because that's the way TV has gone, and music, that you're competing with all of it. And I think you have a better chance of success by doing something less general than that was. If you are a nobody, which we are, and you can't presume that people are going to listen to it. So I think now it's better to pluck something out that is very interesting to you, interesting enough that you think I can make 50 of these or 100 and I could spend years with this idea and I will still be able to cope with this idea when I want to do anything except for make my show this week.
I was gonna laugh at that, but I really didn't want to get it on there.
No, that's all right. That volume of laugh, that's fine.
Okay, I agree with that completely.
Well, I'm right. So you should. This is 10 years of pain talking.
Well, okay. So as you said, I was gonna talk about that and how the not just the podcasting communities have evolved, but the rest of the entertainment industry has kind of followed suit, if you like, and.
No. Yeah, I think they all did it independently of each other. It's quite a logical thing to do, isn't it, to make your material available on demand. I think podcasting has been so slow to develop compared to, like, YouTube started in 2005, which is the same year that Apple added podcasts to the iTunes store, so podcasting effectively started because it was much more possible to obtain them. And yet YouTube caught on really quickly, to the point that it became the generic term for an online video really fast. And people were able to earn money from it, and it was a recognisable thing. And podcasting, there's still a gap between people knowing what it is and how to get it, and what we're doing when we make them. So I think there's still a lot of work to do. It's just a very undeveloped medium.
No, that's true. I mean, I interviewed a guest a few weeks ago. I won't tell you who it was. I won't tell you on this who it was. Mm-hmm. But they said that they'd streamed it on my website because they didn't work out how to get it on their phone. Oh, and wow. So I had to download the podcast player on their phone for them and show them how it worked. And I was a bit like surprised more than anything, because I suppose as a millennial, I'm used to them being there. I mean, I didn't get into podcasting until about 3 years ago, maybe 3.5 years ago, but yeah. I was just a listener then. But I found it so simple to do.
Yeah.
But
it is simple once you know how.
Yeah, but everything's simple once you know how.
Sort of. I don't know. I find my job harder and harder the more I know how to do it. But yeah, my mum can listen to podcasts because she has a tablet now and she's in her late 60s and she can cope. Yeah. Therefore, I think other people who are in their 20s can cope.
Okay. So when you started in 2006, Facebook was a thing and had been for about 2 years.
Well, Facebook had been a private thing. I only joined in mid-2007. It was still, I think 2006 was about the year when it started being open to the public.
Okay.
But barely. Twitter wasn't really a thing yet. In fact, when we started, there was Odeo, which was supposed to be the YouTube for podcasts, and the internal messaging system they used to use with each other was what became Twitter, and Odeo disappeared.
Right.
So that's time we're talking.
Yeah. So I was just wondering how you, as you say, got the internet to care. Or was in the early stages it just you trying to find your feet?
No, well, Ollie at the beginning was very, very publicity minded. And at the time, this was still a thing, MySpace. And we went on MySpace and he said, this is the kind of show we would have enjoyed as teenagers. And we liked the Adam and Joe show and Lee and Herring. So find teenagers. And so we spent a couple of hours a week looking for teenagers on MySpace and befriending them, which sounds worse than it is because they're adults now and some of them are still listening. So that was the way. And then what did we do? Harangued our friends more than I think was sensible early on. I really think you should wait when you've started a podcast until it's good. Because Ollie had a friend called Nick. They are still friends. And he listened to the first one and he thought it was bad because the first one is pretty much always bad. And then when we were still doing it years later, he listened again. He was like, I was really surprised that it was good. He's like, yeah, because there'd been like 200 of it. Hmm. It changed. But if people listen once and they don't like it, it's very unlikely that they will come back, even if a lot of time passes. You can't assume that people will give you a second chance because, again, so much competition. Their attention is being required by so many other things. So it's ruthless and you don't have that many minutes to get it either. So we were always aware of that at the beginning, that we had to grab people within about 30 seconds because they had no reason to care about us.
My first few episodes, I'm aware, are not as good as, for example, the last couple of episodes.
Yeah.
And I'm torn as to whether I should not take them down, but like, have them not appear on iTunes maybe, and like have them only at the subscriber list, And then, because then obviously people will scroll back if they wanted to, if they care enough, and then re-interview those people. Because I'm just sort of worried that they're going to listen to it and go, well, this is shit, and like walk away. I mean, are there stats for that? Or are they, I mean, I assume you...
Well, there aren't really publicly available stats about podcasting trends generally. It's very rare that you hear that, because everyone has their data privately. It's not really like Nielsen or Radar collecting TV and radio data as a kind of proportional sample. So you only have anecdotal data to go on. I think the way that most podcast directories order it means that it's more likely people will start at the most recent and work back. Mm. But there are some people who want to do it methodically, but then they know what they're getting into. That's a pattern that they've clearly done before. I don't love it that people access my early episodes, but I think removing them adds a mystique that you might not want there either.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the other issue, isn't it? Because it's sort of like, well, where does episode 2 go? What was the, you know, did you have a legally compromisable problem or whatever? Okay, so what were you doing at the time did you have a job separate to podcasting, or were you, because you just said you left university by that point?
Oh yeah, I was 26 by that point.
Okay.
Podcasting was not a financially viable activity for years and years and years after I started doing it. And in fact, it's only been my full-time job since I started The Allusionist at the beginning of 2015. So I'd been podcasting for 8 years at that point. And it brought in some money since about 2010, but it grew it to be enough to cover the amount of time I spent on it, but not enough to live off. So I'd been freelance virtually since graduating, and I had lots of different jobs. God, what was I doing in 2006? I worked as like a proofreader and copy editor on books and doing indexes, which is a job humans do, even though you automate it. And I wrote book reviews, and I did some radio writing and performance, and I did some live comedy-ish stuff. Just really whatever I could get paid for that I felt was bearable.
Was the long-term plan, because it sounds like when you started, because you said you were quite ignorant to what even a podcast was, what did you want to be? Because it was a radio presenter plan?
Yeah, I think Ollie and I had always wanted to work in radio, and we'd done some student radio together, and then it was just very hard to get anywhere. And I'd written a bit on The Now Show on Radio 4, and I'd performed on this late night comedy show on Radio 1, but it didn't, and that was pretty exciting, but they didn't lead to anything, and they didn't lead to a continuum. It was a one-off job. And so we thought, well, this would be like a demo. And it wasn't for several years that I could allow myself really to acknowledge that what I wanted to be doing was podcasting, because it wasn't a job. It only seemed like a means to an end, but eventually it became clear that it was the end in itself. And then the industry made it possible for that to be the case. So I think it was the job I always wanted.
So did it help, because I know you've done bits and bobs on radio.
Mm-hmm.
Did it help, did they find you through the podcast and go, oh, she can do this, we'll put her on? Or was it a case of they just didn't even have a clue that you had this sort of, I don't want to say a side project, but I suppose at the time it was. And you just applied because you had the credentials from student radio? Or
no, I never applied for anything like that. Virtually all of the radio work Ollie and I had came as a result of the podcast. But you often have to write to people saying, I do a podcast and here's how I can help you. You know, if you write to somebody going, I would like to do this, and you're leaving it to them to figure out how they can make your career happen, why would they do that? Whereas if you write to them saying, I could come onto your show and talk about this because I am qualified in this way, then it's much less of a demand on their time. So that's how that stuff started. We were talking about the internet then, because at the time the internet was still a separate entity to be talked about in that way, rather than just the place where all the stuff is. And because we were podcasters, they knew we had used it. And so that was often what we were doing. And then from that come other jobs.
Right.
Once you're doing something, it's a lot easier to get more of that something. And then we got nominated a couple of years in for a Sony Award, which is a big deal in the radio industry that has now disappeared. And we were nominated 3 years in a row, and we won a silver and a gold. And that recognition from the industry really made people think, oh, these people are, that's a thing we should pay attention to. So that legitimized us, despite not really meaning anything in the space that we're in. But when you're nominated for something like that, you have this window of opportunity to write to a bunch of people and say, oh, this has happened, maybe I could come in and we could have a chat. And so we had a lot of meetings in those years with people in all sorts of different jobs and different radio stations. And it was rarely the ones that we thought would lead to anything that did. We just went for a meeting with Jonathan Wall, who was the controller at Five Live. I think he was commissioner then. And he's a lovely man, and he had no reason to spend that time. And we went in, he said, "So what do you guys want?" And in a nice way, not like, "What do you want?" Yeah. And we thought, shit, we didn't think about that. We just wanted to get in the room with him. And so we pulled some show idea out of our arses. And he said, "All right, well, maybe we could put that on when the schedule is all over the place on bank holiday." So we made a couple of specials for Five Live. And then he said, "We're starting this new Saturday night magazine show, and you guys will be on it every week." And so that happened for 4 years. And off the back of that, Ollie got a lot more radio work. And we never would have expected it. We never would have expected someone like him to do anything for us in that way. So you have to cast the net wide.
Yeah. And in terms of the early audience and building that early audience, as you said, like, social media isn't really what it was then. No. And you sort of had your teenage friends on MySpace. But I didn't know how else to phrase that.
No, fair enough.
But what was there? Were you sort of running for a core base of audience at that point, or were you just trying to get your how long until you sort of thought, right, we need to have a place for these people to talk to us, or we need something that adds to the community of this, because we feel like we've got a format, we feel like we've got it going?
I think you're thinking in a way that is built by the fact that those facilities exist. When they don't exist, you just make do with what you have.
Right, yeah.
And we weren't going to run a Web 1.0 forum because we did not frequent those places.
Okay.
And I think it took quite a while for me to get into the swing of using Twitter and Facebook. I only signed up to Twitter, actually, because someone signed up as Answer Me This, which I thought was very sad, because I thought, wouldn't you aim higher? If you're posing as anybody, go for someone big that people have heard of. But I think in the early days, in the first year, and we wrote to a lot of journalists as well who were covering podcasts. If we saw someone who wrote about podcasts, we would email them. And it was making their job easier to alert them to the existence of our podcasts, because there were so few, and there were very few British ones at the time. And so old media really helped. I remember we were in the London paper, you know, the old free sheet that used to be given out on the tube that no longer exists. But just that, we had people clicking through for a year to the Answer Me This site from the fact they also had it on their website. Like, the audience peaked a lot whenever we had old media exposure then. But during the first year, we kept going, I think, because the audience kept expanding. So it felt like we were onto something. And then at the end of the first year, we got a promotion from iTunes, and that made the audience just rocket overnight. I don't think it has the same effect now. But then most people got their podcast through desktop iTunes, and if you went on desktop iTunes and there was a podcast featured on it, you would probably click on it.
At least to give it a go. Yeah.
Yeah, and because if you were that keen, you probably were looking for shows and didn't know about them. So that was most people's conduit into podcasts. And so that exposure was really invaluable. And so since that time, a year in, it just kept growing on its own. But it was a very concerted effort in the first year. It was like a part-time job to build the audience. And I don't know how you would do it now. I think it's a lot harder now. There's much more knowledge about podcasting, but there's also a lot more stuff out there. I can't fix it for you.
No, I'm asking yeah. That's fascinating for me, because when I launched this one, I got featured in New and Noteworthy,
yeah,
and I didn't even think to look on iTunes, because I don't go to that for my podcast,
right.
And a friend of mine sent me a screenshot going, "Have you seen this?" And I was like, "No." And he goes, "Well, your download's gone up, because you're on the front page." And I was like, "No." if anything, in the last 3 days they've gone down by about 100 for some reason. Well, it's only because I think people had just downloaded it, so they just I didn't. This was sort of 2-3 months in, so I didn't have the biggest audience anyway. So it just sort of plateaued. But I just find it interesting back then that you would have. So when now, do you think you've reached a peak in your? Do you mind me asking, like, how many subscribers? Do you know how many subscribers you've got?
You don't know ever how many subscribers you've got. You can tell downloads. I don't discuss those figures in public the numbers stick around, but the actual numbers go up. But sponsors know about the ones that are on public record, and so they pay us less than they should.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to.
That's right.
But it's just a case of, I was wondering, do you think your audience has sort of got to capacity at this point then? after sort of 10 years? We're talking about just the Answer Me podcast, at the moment. Or do you think there's always scope to expand it outwards?
So yeah.
You do that? Okay.
Yeah, there are, there are 7 billion people in this world. I think about 5 billion of them have got internet.
Yeah.
I think there are still people discovering it all the time. And most of the Answer Me This audience is in Britain. And whenever we get particularly listeners in America, they love listening to Brits talking, but it's word of mouth over there that they've heard of it. It's never really had PR in America. And then there are other countries where people listen to stuff and understand English. So yeah, I think there's totally places it could still go.
Didn't you once go? I can't remember which country you went to.
Luxembourg. That was what we did at the end of the first year, but that wasn't really to get the inhabitants of Luxembourg to listen to the podcast. That was gaming the system. But this is illustrative of the effort we put in to get our show an audience. And when I tell people it was a part-time job, I think they think sending a couple of tweets, they're working hard. Like we got to number 21 in the British iTunes chart, and the top 20 was full of famous people like Stephen Fry and BBC and Channel 4 podcasts, because Channel 4 radio was a thing then. And we thought, there's no way we can compete with those things, because we're just two people no one's heard of with no resources. So we thought, well, let's go to the place in the world that is like the smallest country that has its own iTunes store, because at the time there were only about 20 countries that had them, and that was Luxembourg, where iTunes happens to be registered as well. So we went there for a day, and we went on the expat radio station on the breakfast show, and then we went to the Christmas market. It's very good, by the way. If you're in Luxembourg in December, it's a really lovely market. We were giving out gingerbread men with a bilingual leaflet on, asking people to subscribe to the show, and they were not into it at all. That is not what Luxembourg likes. They don't like pranks. They don't like people being silly in the streets. They want to get their lamb lunch at the Christmas market and then get back to their bureaucratic or diplomatic jobs. And then we busked jingles, and there were these stupid little stunts. And yet, because it's such a small country, after a day we were number 3. And because iTunes was registered there, we thought, we were filming a little video of this antic. So we thought, well, it'd be funny to go there. It was just a letterbox at the time. Now there are actually people working there. And stuff a huge Christmas card into the letterbox and a box of chocolates, because it was a funny visual. And then a couple of weeks later, we had an email from the guy who was in charge of Britain's podcast saying, well, thanks very much for the card. They hadn't forwarded on the chocolates at this time. Come in and meet me. And so ever since, we've had a very nice relationship with the people at iTunes, because it is run by people, and they're really cool, and they really want to support indie efforts. It's just very hard for them to find them when they're dealing with several hundred thousand podcast feeds. But it's sort of reassuring to know that it is individuals behind this thing, and they listen to a lot of stuff, and they want it to work for people who are nobodies like we were in a living room. But it's just difficult.
That's really interesting. I assumed there would, obviously there's people working behind everything, but I didn't think they'd be listening to, I mean, maybe in their personal life, but do you mean like professionally they are asked to listen to certain podcasts to create
they program New and Noteworthy manually.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So they listen to a lot of stuff, and sometimes they have to listen to a lot of shows in a category they don't particularly care for. I remember speaking to one of them where she'd just spent ages having to listen to, there are a lot of podcasts by female entrepreneurs who just appear to interview each other, and it's a very strange ecosystem. It's a massive facet of podcasting, these business and entrepreneurship podcasts, but I think they have limited appeal outside of that. She was really losing it after having spent so much time trying to find good ones of that she could feature, because they were featuring that category of show.
Yeah.
No, so they suffer.
Yeah, I can imagine. No, that's fascinating. Sorry, I'm literally thinking to myself now, what else do they... Because it makes sense, because I know they've got a Twitter feed, and I know they've got the head banner thing, which I presume they curated, but then I thought New and Noteworthy would have been just automated for stuff that's new that's been submitted or whatever, but that's...
No.
Okay. Okay, so when you started, mm-hmm. and like podcasting was clearly not as prevalent as is now.
It was really not much of a thing at all, and virtually no one knew what it was.
Okay, now, mm-hmm. why do you think it is so popular among comedians?
It was popular among comedians early because comedians love to talk, and it allows them to do that without even having to go and get a gig.
Right.
So comedians were pretty early on it. The iTunes charts were very dominated in Britain, particularly for years, by stand-ups. I think the topics have diversified quite a lot now.
Yeah.
And also there were a lot of comedians in Britain who were frustrated by how impossible it was to get a comedy slot on Radio 4. They were so limited, and the gatekeepers were not that interested in getting too much new stuff on. And podcasting provides another way.
Do you think that's still the case, or do you think that...
I don't really have to deal with radio anymore because I have my own shows.
Okay.
Yeah, they pay better than radio.
Fair enough. You mentioned awards earlier on.
Yeah.
And you, I think you said, I don't want to misquote you, but you think you said that it didn't really make much of an... or it doesn't really mean much in this area.
Like no, a radio. I don't think it does.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now there are podcast awards, like the Chortle have one for like internet stuff. And right. I think they just call it internet content or something like that, yeah, to keep it vague so that it can encapsulate more than podcasts.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your opinions on awards, and do you think they actually, are needed necessarily?
I think where they're helpful is getting attention to things that people might not have heard of. I think that can be very productive. I think where awards are bad is when you pay to enter and then you have to jockey your listeners to vote for you. I think when you are asking people to vote for you, that is doing more for whoever set up the awards than it is for anyone who is nominated. So I don't participate in those. The ones where you pay to enter, sometimes there's just a lot of admin involved with that, and sometimes it's having judged them as well, it is quite an intensive job. And somebody has to administrate. I've never been paid to judge awards. I don't know if that happens. But sometimes they need to hire a venue for people to do that or whatever. They need to pay for the award ceremony. But if it's like 20 quid, I think that's all right. But the Sonys were 100 quid to enter and 200 quid each to go. And then 12 quid for water when you were there. And it just felt like, I think that was very enlightening to me. Because I thought, oh, what awards are is an amazing money-making scheme. So at the Mercury Prize, you pay hundreds to go to that. And so someone is laughing. And it is really less about those rankings. And just so much of it seemed spurious that I thought, okay, well, now you've got one, you don't really need to worry about awards anymore.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
That said, I'm up for an award and it'll be fun if I win it. But also, I don't feel like I'm diminished if I don't.
Which award is it?
So that's... what they call them, the Academy of Podcasters Awards. It's part of Podcast Movement, which is a newish podcaster conference thing that takes place every year in the US. I think the third one is this year. Cool. So that's how long it's been going. And I didn't have to enter that, I think, unless I did it in a dream.
Well, good luck.
Thanks, but it's fine if I don't, because I'm sort of like, well, it doesn't really bother me.
Fair enough.
Nice state to be in, I think. But I think it certainly helps to have had that validation, to feel like that validation isn't worth too much.
Imposter syndrome can sneak in, I imagine, at some point, if you've been doing it a certain amount of time. Mm. And say, I mean, for example, my audience sometimes plateaus for a month or something, and I right. often wonder, or the downloads are about the same 1 month to another month, and I sort of go, have everyone lost interest? Have I sort of ruined, you know what I mean? Right. Or have I been, or are these all bots now? Am I just, you know...
Might be bots, but bots need entertainment, right?
They do, and apparently they really love listening to me.
Great, it's a good audience to have, it's growing.
I'm trying to get them to come down to a gig. They're less keen on that.
Oh, rude.
I'll do a Skype show for them.
Yeah, good.
Don't have to leave my room.
Great.
It's amazing. Okay, so what factors were in place that made you start to try and monetize a podcast? Like, was it a case of other podcasts that started asking for donations, or did you just think, I want this to be my job, so I'm going to make a move?
No, it was way earlier than that, actually. In early 2008, when we'd been podcasting for just over a year, because it started January 2nd, 2007, the burst of publicity we had from iTunes resulted in us busting the bandwidth of our host. And the host doesn't tell you how much bandwidth you'd used. They just took money off Ollie's credit card. So they took $2,000 off Ollie's credit card. And we were like, well, that's pretty mean, because you don't... And our audience was tiny then compared to what it is now, and the number of episodes on the feed was not that big. So if we were paying that amount then, now it would just be completely untenable. We managed to argue them down to, I think, $80 in the end, because it was immoral. And especially as they don't tell you how much, but we thought, we've got to move hosts and we have to have some income coming in to cover this. So we moved to a host that doesn't charge for bandwidth, which I would recommend to everybody, don't go with a host that charges for bandwidth, because they will come and fuck you up.
Who are you with, sorry?
So we are with Libsyn. We moved Answer Me This to Libsyn, and we were with GoDaddy. And Libsyn have been very good. And so we started selling off our first few episodes. And part of that does feed into what you were saying earlier. You didn't want people to hear them. Put them behind a paywall. And they don't hear them as much. But annoyingly, it does mean most people buy the first few, because that's what they're most curious about. So we thought, do we crank the price up? If we charge £200 for episode one. But then I think that's the mystique thing. It looks like it's really valuable just because it has a high price. Price and value are not the same. So that started then, and that has been a steady income for us ever since, increasingly, because we have more and more episodes that are paid for. We always had a lot for free. We always wanted to provide free content because that's nice. And also it gets people into the show. It's only people who are really into the show that are going to buy more when they already have 100 plus free ones to listen to, and then all of the other people's shows. And at the time there were shows that were paywalled, and it would just make their audience stop growing, and we didn't feel like we could afford to do that, and we didn't think we had the entitlement to ask people for money. And I think people are a lot more used to hearing about it now. In America they're used to it because their radio stations have always asked for money, but because that doesn't happen here, we felt like we could neither do it nor would be justifiable to do it. And then we first started carrying ads in 2010 because we were approached by Audible. So it really came from them. And all of our advertisers have approached us so far on Answer Me This. And that made a significant difference to the income.
Okay. And when they approached, because I mean, I've been approached about sponsors before, and I felt a little bit, I don't know, just worried about doing that. I don't know.
Why?
Because I don't like adverts. Mm-hmm. So I feel quite uncomfortable, especially plugging. If it was something that I used or liked, I suppose I'd be less worried about telling other people, because I would do that anyway.
Yeah.
But most of the ones I've contacted are not ones that I would necessarily have used or even knew about prior to this.
Yeah. There are a lot of products that I wouldn't have known about were it not for podcasts. I think your options are to be unpaid, to take money from your audience, which can have its problems, and also depends on your audience. Sometimes your audience doesn't really have the spare cash, and you really have to count on them being very devoted to you. Or you can do ads, and I would rather make my show and carry ads, but I've always been very stubborn about how I will do the ads, so that I feel like they're an okay experience for the listener. So even if they don't care, they're not switching off. And that also means that they're more likely to act on the ad if there's some code they need to use or something, because they haven't, their attention hasn't wandered elsewhere because of the stupid way in which I'm talking about the product or doing a jingle about it or something. So that's why, Answer Me This, we do jingles about them, and they're very irreverent because Audible got it. Audible, the first time we did Audible, we were quite respectful. And then much later in the show, we just happened to be talking about, I think, something like listening to an audiobook of Mein Kampf on the toilet. And the Audible guy was like, yeah, more of that. And we thought, okay, cool. Well, and then we just tested the boundaries, and they never complained about anything, because they knew that it made them look better, because it made the product seem cool, and it made the audience trust it. And we said, you can cancel your membership at any time. And to them, intuitively, they don't want people to know that. But for our listeners, it's much easier to opt in when you know that you can opt out.
Yeah.
And then once you've opted in, you're less likely to opt out, I think.
Yeah.
And Squarespace have been the same. We do these increasingly stupid jingles about Squarespace, because everyone who listens to podcasts has heard about Squarespace so many times. And we didn't want to just do the same script that everyone else was doing. But there's only so much you can say about Squarespace when you've been sponsored by them for years and written 20 jingles about them. So the jingles got stupider and stupider, and we were expecting Squarespace at some point to go, listen, guys, no. And instead, they would just say things like, do you enjoy sharing these around the office? So maybe we're just Squarespace's pet stupid project. So I think you don't have to make compromises that you're uncomfortable with. I've never had to advertise a brand that I have been uncomfortable with. I have turned down a couple because I thought that's not a product the listener is interested in. There was one of the massive investment banks, and I thought, I don't know what they expect to get out of it. But also, the listener, they'll be like, why is this happening?
Yeah.
There's nothing in it for either side. So yeah. I didn't.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I suppose I presume that you haven't Googled me. My day job is in social media marketing. So I do a lot of stuff with Facebook ads or YouTube advertising or that kind of stuff. And I'm aware that I suppose with sponsorship it's different, but with generic advertising, the pay is so low on the CPM that means that I don't... And I think people... I've just written a book about this, and in it I was talking about... I'll send you a copy. It's called How to Make a Living by Working for Free, so you might enjoy it.
Done it, mate.
Thing. It's one of these things where I had three people send me messages saying, well, have you done it yet? And I'm like, no, but I've worked for 6 years in social media. I've worked for 5 years in comedy and for 2 years in podcasting. Mm-hmm. I know the route that you need to go down and that there is kind of a route for it now. And the book doesn't tell you how to do it. It just tells you what happens.
You would be an idiot to get into any of those things for the money.
Oh, yeah, no.
But if it results, then you feel pleased.
Yeah.
Like, if you expect it, then it's going to be a disappointment.
And you also reduce your chances of it happening.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then when it does happen, as it has for me, you're like, phew. Yeah, brilliant.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, so because I know the low numbers of the CPMs and because my audience is not... So I get a couple of thousand downloads on every episode when it starts up, and then probably every week I get maybe 10 to 20 downloads after the first month of, you know, the episode being out, sort of thing. So my audience isn't big enough that the return rate on a sponsor would be enough that it would validate me putting an advert on it.
Yeah, that's how we felt with Answer Me This as well. There was always a financial point below which we thought it wasn't worth having the interruption.
Yeah.
And I think generally, whether you're going... for milking your audience for cash or adverts, it's very hard to make any significant money from podcasting if your audience is under about 50,000 people.
As in per episode?
Yeah.
I thought you meant as subscribers. Okay.
Well, that's sort of the same.
No, because I don't think every person on my subscriber list will be listening to every episode.
Right, but if you're doing something like Answer Me This, where it's kind of the same product each time, then the audience is consistent, whereas if you're doing an interview show, people will download the ones where it's someone they're interested in and not the other ones. So you probably see more variation than I do with Answer Me This or The Illusionist.
Makes sense.
But you get a much higher CPM if you do ads in a personalised way, as I choose to do.
Well, that's probably the way I would do it if I did that. And if I ever got to a stage where my audience was 50,000, or it was getting 50,000 per episode, I would probably approach some brands that I like and say, can I do an advert? However, I don't know if I would then, because I have a Patreon. I don't know what you think of that as a platform.
It's good. I've not used it. I do Patreonize some people, but I've not tried to earn money myself that way. But I like the idea that those things are possible now.
Is there any reason why you haven't used it?
Well, for Answer Me This, we've just never done crowdfunding, and The Illusionist Radiotopia has a different crowdfunding model. They built their own, basically.
Okay, fair enough. So for Answer Me This, would you say that the majority of the support for that is sponsorship then?
Yeah.
And then you
and people buying the old episodes and bonus content.
And you've got merch, I believe.
Merch is not for money. Like, there's no markup on the merch.
Oh, is there really? Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. That's really interesting.
The base price is expensive, so it's really just for people who want merch, but it's not a moneymaker.
Interesting. I've just interviewed Ray Peacock from the Parapod, and he was saying that we were talking about how he's had to budget it out so that the people that donate a certain amount get stuff and vice versa, so that they can cover costs and get the products out to people.
The stance we always took with Answer Me This is that we were selling digital audio products because we knew that that's what people already wanted because they already liked the podcast. And also that is endlessly replicable. Once you put in the initial effort, you don't have to package things up and take them down to the post office, and you don't have to store t-shirts anywhere or all that stuff. There's no cost per unit once you've made it. So I would certainly recommend that as an approach that makes your life easier and gives people the thing that they want. And also, there's a long tail on it. Stuff that we made nearly 10 years ago is earning us money. Whereas if people buy a t-shirt, they're like, okay, well, I've supported that show. You might get £2 from them buying that t-shirt and that's it. Whereas this, they might buy episodes 1 to 10 and be like, okay, well, now I want 1 to 40. And they keep buying them and other people keep buying them. So that has worked out a lot better for us, I think, than selling physical merch.
Yeah. No, I can imagine that.
It's an effort per thing sold in a way that the other things aren't.
Yeah, I mean, my book at the moment is being formatted by Amazon, and I'm really excited to get a physical copy. However, I know that I can put a digital download store on my website as well as Amazon, which means that I'd get more for it because it'd be direct from me, but also I keep the information. So like when you sell something on Amazon, you don't get their email address, for example. Whereas if they do it direct with me, I can email them in 6 months' time and say, hey, I've got another book if I do, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of other advantages as well, because if someone buys a physical thing, you can't exactly send them a postcard in the mail going, I've got a new book. Like, it seems a bit...
Yeah, well, you could, but they'd probably not even open it. And also, if people are listening all over the world, then that is another cost and another load of pain.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's just like... It's such a time-consuming thing anyway to do podcasting. Just think of ways that you can make your life easier.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. How would you... Because I read a thing online. Mm-hmm. I try and research the guests as much as possible beforehand so I don't double up on questions that you've already been asked.
Oh.
But, okay, well...
I've probably said all these things elsewhere, so apologies for not having anything original to say.
No, it's fine. Yeah. I'm going to presume no one's heard those things because I spend ages on the internet looking people up. But one of the things I read was you said, I think you spend how many hours a week editing? It was like 12, 15?
It's hard to gauge. Answer Me This, each episode takes 3 days, but that's three long days. The Illusionist takes far longer. Like, I had like very few days off last year when I was producing... I put out 54 podcasts in 2015, and they were all produced by me. And that might not sound much, but like when something takes maybe 8 days to produce, then the other thing takes 3 days, and then you've rolled over into the next fortnight. It just doesn't leave you much time to do other things, and it's very taxing. And the hours are long and antisocial. It's a strange antisocial job when you're editing audio, which is the time-consuming thing, and you're just looking at a waveform of your own voice.
Yeah, I know exactly what looks like in a wave format for myself.
Nice.
No, it's not.
Yeah, so it makes you hate the sound of your own breathing as well. Editing.
Yeah. Oh, like, you,
great
like
job though. Everyone should give it a go.
When I was chatting to Ray, Barry Dodds was there as well, and he kept going off on I don't know if you've heard the Parapod, but he went off on a load of tangents. And at the end, when Barry had to leave, I said to Ray, "I'm really not looking forward to editing that." And he goes, "That's why I was really happy you came, because I like other people having to edit him, not me." It was really fun. Yeah, it's one of those things. But I think that's interesting. I mean, I have stopped keeping track of how long it takes me to edit these.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't keep track. It's not like I'm notching off the hours. I'm too busy.
Yeah. No. I mean, I bought my laptop to edit on the track. I mean, you know, it's one of those things. But I think it's interesting because most people, when they talk to, like, when they ask me how to get started, and I made a little blog on my website, like an indie guide on how to start making, like how to set up a podcast. But most people then message me a week later going, how do you make this editing thing quicker? And I don't know if you've got any tips or hints or things you learnt along the way that...
No, it's got slower. Because I'm...
I have to look mic for that one.
Well, like, Answer Me This, it's a very methodical job. I do kind of know how long that will take. And I know that it will take roughly four times as long as the piece of stuff I've got to edit. The thing is, I'm editing for content. Some people are just editing to take ums and ahs out. I'm editing to take everything out that doesn't need to be there. And it might not sound like that. It might not sound like a minimalist show, but that is the intention. And I think a lot of people aren't. And one thing that really, really bothers me, that I think is kind of a schism in podcasting in particular, is people equating editing with dishonesty. I equate it with not wasting the listener's time, because they have been generous enough to give you that time. Don't give them unedited shit, because there's no other form that isn't prepared before or edited after, and usually both. Like, if you're writing something, if you're painting something, you're making all these decisions about what isn't going to be in it. And yet in podcasting, people are like, yeah, you just talk for 2 hours and you put that out, and that is the key. And you're like, no, that's idiotic.
No,
it drives and me presumptuous.
Crazy. Yeah.
It's arrogant.
Yeah, I got a message from someone, I won't say who, but it was a comedian about 2 weeks ago, and they'd started listening to my podcast, and they sent me an email saying, I really loved the show, but they'd picked out one episode and gone, I felt like you were just trying to get this one up to a time, because like it was quite, like it had a lot of filler in it. I was like, huh? First of all, up to what time?
Yeah.
Every episode.
Internet time.
Yeah, every episode's a different length on mine, because
yeah.
I don't.
Yeah, same.
You know, but, and also, like, why would I do that? Like, why would I go, oh, I'll just leave in that 20 minutes of coughing, because that's definitely what everyone wants to hear. Like, I know, because people were complaining about the length of my intros at one point, because mm-hmm. I was taking about 2 to 3 minutes on an intro.
How dare you? But like I said, though, you have so little time to catch people's yeah. attention. It's like 19 seconds or so on the, and it feels like 5 minutes.
Well, this is why now what I do, and it's a little bit of a trick, is I take a snippet of something you've said, put it at the start, so when they hit play it's immediately you talking, and then I cut it and then do an intro, so they sort of know what they're getting, and then they get the whole episode, if that makes sense.
I've heard that trick.
Yeah.
Yep.
Are you from mine or from others?
Others. Yeah.
Others. Okay.
Yeah. I've done it myself.
Yeah. It's I think it's helped.
Yeah.
Because I think it would help with me if I was listening to it as well.
Yeah.
And it also gets me, also when I listen to it back before I'm about to hit, you know, upload, I quite like that when I hit play, it's not my voice going. It's like the other person's, and it's something exciting.
Nick Van Der Kolk, who makes Love and Radio, he really likes it when podcasts drop people into the middle. Because in radio, there's a lot of hand-holding, and they do have to hit the 28 or 58 minute mark. So often they do have to leave in fillers so that it is long enough. In podcasting, you don't need to do that. And also, the one thing you know about podcasts, people have been listening from the beginning. It's not like in radio where someone might walk in halfway through, so they recap all the time. And therefore, I think you can take some greater leaps of faith that the listener is paying attention and will follow you if you are quite demanding of them. And he loves it when they disorient the listener.
Yeah.
And my work isn't really predicated to that, because it's entertainment and it's not that outre. But as a listener, I do like it. I don't like being condescended to. There's a podcast feed called Seriously, which is of Radio 4 documentaries. And what they do is explain exactly what you're going to hear before then they play the documentary. And I'm like, why did you do that? Now I don't need to listen to it.
Yeah.
It's annoying. But I don't know what they're thinking by doing that. Maybe they'll listen to this and think,
maybe she's right.
She's right.
Yeah.
She's right. Go with it, Radio 4. Just try it. Just try my way for a couple.
When I was chatting to Ben Walker, he said that when he's putting together an episode, he tries to make them... He's thought about how long the average person's commute is and has tried to make it an hour so that they can sort of listen to one episode from start to finish.
That's a very London-centric commute time.
Yeah. I thought about that after we said that.
Because Answer Me This started at 25 minutes, because we thought that fits into a lot of people's journeys, even though we live in London, so it didn't take an hour to get anywhere, but that means in that hour you can listen to two of them or someone else's show. I think asking people to listen to an hour of something, particularly when you're starting out, is unrealistic.
Right.
I think when you're starting, particularly, shorter the better. Once people are in, then you can be a bit looser if you want.
But surely if people start usually at the top and work their way backwards, if their episodes are getting progressively slightly longer.
Yeah, but if they're better and longer, that's all right.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
No, I was wondering if that had ever come into your... I mean, obviously, at the start, it sounds like, you said 25 minutes is sort of your aim for that.
Yeah.
But if you'd ever sort of said, right, we'll never make an episode longer than this, or we'll never...
Yeah, it's tacitly there, because Answer Me This grew to being 25 to 30, and then we went from being weekly to fortnightly, so we made it longer. So now it's usually 38 to 43 minutes. And it would only be on special occasions that we made it longer than 45, like the best of episode or something. A landmark episode would be longer, but that would be one every year. And because you know roughly how much of it someone needs, or you should know that. Like The Illusionist, I could make it as long as I want, but I would really like it to be 13 minutes each time. It isn't. It varies from like 12 to 20, but I feel like 13 is the right length for it.
And in terms of, if you were to compare working for your own shows to working on something for the BBC, for example, other than the obvious control element that you get for this versus what you'd probably get on the BBC, I'm not trying to pigeonhole them, I'm just, yeah. I know you've done some stuff for them.
It's a bit, whenever there are other people involved, then compromises start to happen and right. different layers of stuff you have to go through happen, inevitably, right. yeah. whoever it is.
So what would you say are the biggest advantages and disadvantages of podcasting versus working for any radio slash
yeah. agent? Well, podcasting, you get to do what you want and you don't have to wait for permission. So I've been in Radio 4 commissioning processes where it's a once a year opportunity to get one 30-minute slot in 18 to 24 months' time. And I'm like, I could make this show and put it out in 4 days. So why would I wait? Because the money is not particularly great. And so why don't I just do it? So if you're used to being able to make stuff, then radio is kind of painful. But there is a certain kudos in some people's minds that you're on the radio. So I guess there's that. People still respect the medium. And sometimes you'll learn things that you can't learn on your own because you're collaborating with people and you're operating in a different medium. But generally, I do prefer podcasting. It is fun to do live radio because that is quite a different skill to doing podcasts, which are all pre-recorded. And it's good to keep those muscles alive occasionally.
What are the best things that have come out of podcasting in terms of opportunities or experiences?
Apart from podcasting being my job now, which is the absolute best. And
apart from that.
Yeah, and the people I've met through it, the podcasters and also listeners, that has been really great. Like making connections with people through this thing, and a lot of my really good friends are people who that was the initial contact. And before that, in 2010, we had a couple of great jobs that resulted from Answer Me This. We wrote a book, and that was published by Faber and Faber, who have, it's T.S. Eliot founded it, and they have like Sylvia Plath stuff and Alan Bennett stuff and Samuel Beckett and us. Mm. And so we were like, well, this is ridiculous, but they don't seem to be joking. So that was really cool. And also that year, Visit Britain paid us to go on holiday around Britain and make stupid little videos. And being paid on to go on holiday is as good as you would think it is.
And what are the like disadvantages of podcasting then? Like what were the sticking points that made you sort of go, I mean, were there any times, I mean, obviously it's great that you get to do it all yourself, but were there any moments where you just went, maybe I'll keep applying for sort of the mainstream roles in different radio industries?
But I've never really, except for the first couple of years of my career, I was never really applying for jobs like that.
Okay.
I think it's a very difficult thing to do long term. People think that starting a podcast is hard, but carrying on is so much harder, particularly if, wait for that to go, just one disadvantage of recording here.
I used to live with my girlfriend in Acton, and mm-hmm. there were two police stations between like the where we were,
oh,
and as a result
shit.
Every like sort of yeah, because the first that's another reason why I want the first five to come back down, because I've listened back to the second one and I've tried to edit it down, like because I'm facing the window and they're not, yeah. so my mic picks it up a lot more,
yeah, yeah.
but even with it on the lowest thing, you still have it on the rib of the rib, not reverb or whatever there's, yeah. And I mean, there are a couple of times where I've had to say to the guest, can you just wait yeah. a sec, but they're in like the flow and you don't want yeah. to sort of stop them. And
yeah, I always regret that afterwards though, when I should have said something at the time, or yeah. I should have like stopped interviewing them at that time and done it a later time with better sound. I was saying, yeah, people think that starting is the hard thing with podcasting, but carrying on is a lot harder because it is quite a solitary thing to do, and often it feels like you're doing it for no reason. Because for most of the years I was doing it as well, I was a successful podcaster, but that was an absolutely meaningless thing to be, because no one knew who it was, no one knew what podcasting was. So that's like just shouting into an empty room. And it was only because other things were coming off the back of it that it seemed worth carrying on before it became evident that it was an end in itself. So the last couple of years have been a lot easier because podcasting's a thing now. But that is really hard. And being sick of your own voice is hard. And I do all these jobs making the show, and really I only want to do a couple of them. I don't want to be doing everything from like the lowliest thing to like mastering the whole production, but I do. That adds up to a lot of time and can make you a bit demented.
yeah I got that. I mean, I'd love to ask you what all the roles are that you all the hats you wear, because I mean I suppose there's probably a few I'm missing out, because I started this very ignorantly as well. As in, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I don't have anyone else that helps me with it. I do yeah. absolutely everything. in terms of marketing and getting out there and building the communities and also editing, recording, bringing, you know, that kind of stuff. So yeah, maybe it's a good, maybe for listeners who are maybe looking at starting a podcast who don't know every role that would come into it.
Oh, I don't want to scare them.
I do.
Right, so...
maybe if we take it from step one of you haven't got an episode to putting an episode out.
Yeah, so if it's The Illusionist, I have to think of the idea and then I have to think, what would be an interesting way to pursue this idea? And then who could I talk to get the material for that idea? And then once I've talked to them, I transcribe that. And that is where the direction of the show starts to become apparent. And then I think, do I need someone else to be on this? How could I sound design this? Which is not a natural talent I have. And I'm doing all the engineering myself as well, which is not a natural talent I have. Don't care how mics work. Don't care how the recording software works, all of that. Don't care. But I have to do it. And then I'm editing. I taught myself to edit for Answer Me This, taught myself to run a website, all of that. And then writing the script and then like doing all of the finicky little details to make sure the sound quality is consistent, because when you're listening on headphones, differences in volume are very, very annoying and sometimes very painful if there's a sudden loud noise or if suddenly the volume drops out and you can't hear it because you're on a train. And then using the various things you do to release an episode, and then doing a website post that makes it as easy as possible for people to listen to an episode. So there's iTunes and there's SoundCloud and there's like direct download and there's a clickable player and there's the RSS feed and there's information about the episode as well. There's all this stuff. As much stuff as possible that I feel like people will need without it being a huge sprawling thing that means that they don't have to listen because all the information is there. And then there's the publicising. But way before that point, I've become sick of it and I just really don't want to have to do it anymore. And then it has to start again. Then I'm like, okay, well now you have the 10 minutes of peace between the episode being out and the first person complaining about it. So that is the most peaceful part of my job.
Okay.
That every fortnight, not 10 minutes.
I ask every guest this. They're quick fire for me. You take as long as you would like to answer them.
Yeah.
So, and also, again, not all of them might be something you can answer or want to answer. Sure. Blah, blah, blah.
Don't worry, I've answered questions before.
I've
answered like 5,000 for Answer Me This.
This is, honestly, it's literally just me on autopilot when I say stuff like that, because I say it to every guest.
Go for it.
Okay, so what are the best books on... Well, normally I would ask what are the best books on comedy writing or stand-up you've read, but how about if we said what are the best books on podcasting, editing, or stuff?
Know. If you go to a book to learn how to do something with the internet, then it will be out of date by the time it's published. I know you've just written one.
I know.
So maybe yours. But we had Podcasting for Dummies and another one when we started... and they were so complicated that we almost gave up before we began. I would suggest not using a book.
Okay, fair enough. For the record, my book is not about putting stuff on the internet. It's about building a community around what you do.
Great.
Okay.
Better.
What is the best show, podcast-wise, you've ever listened to? It can be an episode or a series.
I really like 99% Invisible because every time I think I am familiar with that subject, they do something with it that I was not expecting. They did one about the kids on the side of milk cartons that was not what you'd expect. They did one about the Octothorpe, which is the official name for a hashtag, which I think we'd covered on Answer Me This a few months ago, so I put off listening to it. And of course, they did magical things with it. And the thing I know about it is that it will not waste my time. And I have so little time now to listen to podcasts, which is sad because there's editing in my ears all the time, that... it has to count when I spend that time, and preferably it has to be short, because if I have an hour, I could listen to 3 20-minute different shows or 1 hour-long thing. I would rather listen to 3 different ones and hear what 3 different shows are doing. So that one.
Okay.
I don't think you'd be disappointed. It's got a bit of everything.
No, I listened to the Tim Ferriss podcast, and he recommended an episode of that recently, and so I subscribed after listening to that one because it was just really, really good.
Yeah.
I just thought it was really well done. Yeah. So yeah, I'd back that one up. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made, and how did you overcome it?
Oh, God. What, in life?
It can be in life, it can be in podcasting, it can be in writing, it can be in or any area that you've ever been in, because you've been in
loads. Yeah, I have. I don't... Well, these are usually the things that I'm subconsciously thinking about all the time. And whenever I think of one, I want to punch myself in the head. And now you've asked me, I'm like, no, everything's been fine. When I was at university, I fell asleep in a one-on-one tutorial in like the world expert of that subject.
Wow.
But it was very hot and I'd been up all night writing the essay for it. So that was very embarrassing. There were things like the fact that there are so many hours of Answer Me This on record means that if I go back even a year, I think you probably wouldn't make that joke now. You wouldn't use that word now. You wouldn't edit it like this now, but I just have to not dwell on that because I can't sanitize the past, but I do have certain regrets. And I hate the fact there's an exclamation mark in the title. I've never been on board with that.
I was going to ask how you got over that, but I don't think you
can't get over the exclamation mark. Everything else I get over by just not thinking about it.
Is that Ollie?
Yeah.
Okay. What is the most... I think I probably asked you this in a weird way, actually, or you've answered it in a weird way, okay. But I'm going to ask it again to see if you get a different answer.
Uh-huh.
What is the most interesting thing you do that nobody ever gets to see in relation to your work?
Oh. Oh. I always think that everything I do is really humdrum.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah, I know. But I think everything I can do is absolutely ordinary. And the reason why other people don't do it is because it's not worth doing. That's my underlying... That stops me from getting too arrogant. Because I think generally I'm overpraised for my work. The insight we get into people's minds reading through our emails to answer me this is really great. Because people tell us some very personal stuff, very private stuff. And not all of it is suitable for the podcast. Either because it's a comedy show, and if someone's talking about something very difficult, like we've got a lot of teenagers listening, a lot of them are struggling with anxiety or depression or self-harm. Those are not issues for a comedy show to rip apart, obviously. But the fact they feel like they can tell us is extraordinary, and the fact that we've built this one-sided relationship with them is amazing. And sometimes just someone will send a really funny email that doesn't have a question in it, but it's very enjoyable to read, and they probably never even know how enjoyable we found it because we don't have time to answer. So that's cool. And with The Illusionist, it's just the fact that I learn stuff. I go into every episode ignorant, because if I know how things are going to unfurl, I'm just not interested in pursuing it.
Who do you think is the most underrated person in the podcast industry?
Oh man, but if I say someone, then everyone's going to think, well, she's suggesting that they're not popular. One person I really appreciate in Britain, and even more since the podcast Gold Rush has started, is a man called Dave Pickering, who's been podcasting for a very long time.
I know him, yeah.
Yeah, and I know him through podcasting, and I first met him when I was on his podcast, Getting Better Acquainted. And he approaches it in a different way to most people, in a way that I think is of great value, because an industry is forming and so much of it is like just money or benefit to me, whereas him, it just feels like a very pure form of communication, which I feel like I want to nurture that and protect it. It's very uncynical and very sincere, and he really puts himself out there. Like, my work is not generally about me, and it doesn't have my emotions in it. Like, a lot of people's shows are where it's sort of like a reality show where they're generating the material. I'm not naturally given to do that because I think I'm boring and I don't do anything. I just stay at home editing. It's boring. But people who can make their emotions into something that's compelling to other people who don't know them, I think that's a real talent. And I think that's much more of a genre in the States. But here, I listened to a Christmas episode of Getting Better Acquainted that Dave did in 2012. And I still think about it 3.5 years later as just something that I could never do and really struck me very deeply.
I have to find that one. I did his Comedy Night Stand-Up Tragedy, and he records them and puts them out as a podcast. And I'd recommend, if you're listening, I'd recommend that as a podcast to listen to as well. He's very, I really like him. He's a lovely guy as well.
He's lovely. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Support Dave Pickering.
Yes.
He's one of the good people.
Please do.
Yeah.
What do you think is the biggest problem in the podcasting industry, and how would you go about solving it?
Ooh, I think not editing is one big problem. All the bad podcasts, because when people listen to a podcast for the first time, they will often judge the whole of podcasting on that. So if they get something as a sprawling mess, they're like, that's podcasting, which is damaging. I think the fact that it's so difficult for people to be able to find an audience and to be able to afford to do it, I think that is a problem. And I think it can cut out people that would make really interesting shows that took a lot of time to do and they had something very original to say because they can't afford to spend that time. Like, if you're already working two jobs and you have kids to support and stuff like that, like, how can you justify doing that? So that's an issue. I think it's still a very white medium. It's still very male dominated. So it's just like diversifying would be great. Other problems. I think it could still be easier to make podcasts and upload them and for people to download them. I think there are still a lot of annoying steps involved in doing that. That are a barrier to people doing either of those things.
How would you go about solving any of those
things? I can't solve these things.
Okay.
Like, I mold myself around around what's available, so I don't get too frustrated at what I can't control that I find inadequate. That's my survival technique.
Okay.
Not saying it's good.
No, it's fine. What is the best bit of advice you've ever been given? And it can be something that you've never actually used, because a lot of people have said stuff and they've gone, "He told me this," and I still haven't used it. So yeah.
Advice. It's usually me giving other people advice. The advice that Ollie was given before we started the show, make sure it's not two people talking shit, that was invaluable. Like, that was the difference between the show being bad and being not bad. But I think, what advice have I had? Starting The Illusionist, this is odd, it wasn't exactly overt advice, but getting to make that show and getting to be part of Radiotopia, it was almost like they were giving me permission to do the best work that I could, and I didn't even know what I was capable of, and I couldn't have done it had I not been given permission. And I think it's partly like when you're entering something like a commissioning process and you're like, well, there's no point emotionally investing too much when I have this 1 in 2,000 chance of doing this thing, so you hold back. Whereas when someone says, okay, we can pay you to make a show, off you go, there's quite a lot of pressure on it because people assume you're going to make a good show. You think, okay, well, how can I make this opportunity as good as possible while I've got it? If you get that chance to take a risk, then take it and push yourself really hard. Because it wasn't like, oh, finally I'm getting money to do what I want, you can sit back. It's more like you're getting money to do what you want, so don't waste it, because you know what it's like not to have that.
If you could give some advice to someone who has not ever podcasted before and has not maybe even heard one before, you know, they just want to start one because they think it'd be something good for them to even try.
Yes.
What would be your sort of top, say, 5 bits of behind the scenes information that you would have loved to have been told about the production?
I would have loved to have been told. Let's leave that out because I don't want to regret the inadequate knowledge I had. I think people get very hung up on what they think they need to have sorted before they start. So both the equipment, people are very daunted and it can look like a lot of outlay. And if you look it up online, people are saying, oh, you need a mixing desk and here's this £300 mic. I think the thing is, you can do a lot with very little now. And phone recording quality is remarkable. Like, if you're in an okay room and you're holding the phone right, you can put that out on the radio. So work out what you can spend and then get the equipment that works for that. Don't think you have to have this amount of money's worth of equipment to make it work. And similarly with your idea, I kind of want people to push their ideas as much as possible, because you can do so much in audio. I think it'd be very difficult to do in video without the budget and the equipment, but in audio it's so much more forgiving and you can be ingenious with it. But most of us, and I include myself in this, are not. So see how far you can push your idea, but within what is possible for you to actually produce, because some people, it's so ambitious or so esoteric, it's not practically a going concern. So it's finding that balance. And also, don't expect it to be good straight out the gate, because no one's is. Or if the first episode's the best one, then that's a bad scenario as well. So just be forgiving of yourself. Like, make one, but then make sure you make another one, another one, another one, and do it regularly and close together, because then you will learn quicker how to be good. Whereas if you just wait until you feel like doing it, then you never will, because you'll be like, oh, I was shit last time, so I'm not really in the mood. You have to get over your own shitness because you forced yourself to make another one. Yeah, I can't emphasize that enough. And think long term. You know, the first 10 might look uphill, but think, is there enough in this to make 50 or 100 or 200? Like, in 8 years' time, am I still going to enjoy this theme or this idea?
So if you go back in a DeLorean and talk to yourself for just a minute before you sort of were going to say yes to Ollie, to give yourself just a nugget of information from the future, or just something that would maybe have guided you slightly differently, what would you say to yourself?
Don't allow the exclamation mark in the title.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thanks, Simon.
That was Helen. I really enjoyed that. I know I say it every time. I think a big takeaway for me from that was how time poor you can become when you invest more time in creating content online, and how that kind of makes a divide in people who create content and people who consume content. I would love to listen to more podcasts. I've got loads of ones suggested to me recently, and I've downloaded a few episodes, but I haven't really got around to listening to them. And I totally understand her point about not wanting to invest in ones that you don't trust the person in. And I'm hoping to make these edits tighter, which respects your time more. But if they're over an hour, they're over an hour. If they're under an hour, they're under an hour. I want to make sure sure that the only things I leave in are the stuff that I think you'll get value from, because I don't want to waste any of your time. If you like this chat and you want to learn more about building an audience for your podcast, please do think about buying my book. I've just sent off the final edits to Amazon, and I'll have the printed copy soon in my possession, which would be exciting because I'm moving house at the same time. So I don't even know what address to get them sent to, which would be interesting, I guess. But if you want to pre-order a copy of How to Make a Living by Working for Free, which is all about how to find your audience, develop it, grow a connection with them, and then ask them for support if they value what you do, you can get a digital copy for £5 or a paperback copy for £8 plus postage and packaging, or you can get a signed copy. You can get all of them on my website. All the links are in the show notes, or you can go to simonkane.co.uk/shop. Alternatively, if you don't want to buy a copy of the book but you want to support the podcast, please do give it an honest review or share this with someone that you think will get some value out of it. All of these things maintain and support the thing that you value. So please do consider doing some of these things. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you very much for buying my book if you do. And I will see you all in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.